I'd like to make a few opening comments and then let Marilyn make some comments, and we'll just open it up to discussion. First of all, I'd like to say that there are several problems which underlie this paper. The first of which is something that, well, it's called varying things by varying people. Some of you remember Larry and Rasmussen from the summer. He and Bruce Birch called it the predicament of the prosperous. Ron Sider in another book has called it Rich Christians in a Hungry World. And from an entirely opposite position, Garrett Hardin, who is usually seen on the other side of the coin, has called it lifeboat ethics in a way. Now, that doesn't really fit the situation. The question is, what do people, and he called it lifeboats. Other people said it's like a yacht going through the water with the poor people laying in the water. And for me, at least, it's how do we live just, sustainable, and participatory lives. The question of lifestyle is at the center of this. The second problem is the great gulf between the realities of our experience, life as it's lived, and at least in some places, the ethics of Jesus. We have the example of the Sermon on the Mount and other places in the teachings and certainly the life of Jesus, where a very rigorous, I call it rigorous, a very strenuous ideal is established, particularly in the Sermon on the Mount, and such things as turning the other cheek, the missionary call to his disciples to give, to go around on their missionary journeys without, you know, possessions. His own life was certainly lived with simplicity. He exhorted people to give all they had to the poor. And a number of other places. All these are materials one would ask oneself whether we should be living these teachings. Should we attempt in some way to be like Jesus? There are other biblical materials which are less strenuous, but the problem of putting together the rigorous and the less rigorous is one that perennially confronts us. And I must say that the paper itself results from my own struggle. This is not a dry academic paper, but trying in my own mind to figure out for myself which way to go with this problem. But even beyond that, a fourth problem is how do we interpret the Bible? And what materials are relevant for an age that's very much different than the biblical age. The biblical age was not beset with the same limits to consumption. Poverty was general, not out of the ordinary. At least for a country like ours, it's out of the ordinary. And finally, this essay, in a sense, points to a problem that's occurred throughout the history of Christianity, and that is a kind of two-path way. The two paths were, in the Middle Ages, the more rigorous kind of ethic was incumbent upon the monks and the clergy. They didn't always live up to that rigor, but it was incumbent upon them. And then the mass of other people had a less rigorous ethic which they were to live. And there was a differentiation or split between the clergy and the laity, which was, at least to Luther's mind and the other reformers' mind, a very disruptive kind of split. It reached such extremes in the Middle Ages where the clergy were the only ones who participated in the Eucharist, and the lay people were the ones who observed. And so Luther came along and talked about the priesthood of all believers and made those rigorous, or at least apparently those rigorous kinds of, that rigorous kind of ethic incumbent upon everybody. The genius of the Middle Age ethic was that there are differences between people, and some people find it more or less easy to live that rigor. The error was to make a split between these two people. So the problem is, how do you maintain the rigor and still at the same time live in the real world with your own problems, your own psychological hang-ups, and the shell that you get hanging on your back? Okay, that's I would like Marilyn to comment, because the two positions that I have established in the essay are what we would call ideal types. They are kind of composites, which nobody can be found to fit a composite like that. And the reason I've asked Marilyn to comment is because while I follow one or tend towards one type, and not, I don't think, live all the elements of that type, she tends towards another. And I'd like, in my own thinking here, to try to keep these types together, not to separate them as they did in the Middle Ages, but at the same time realize that there's kind of distinctions between people, and there are a variety of gifts and a variety of spirits, as Paul put it, but the same spirit, but a variety of gifts, as Paul says. Well, Marilyn, why don't you make a few comments?
Mm-hmm. in some respects, this paper points to a question that we all ask ourselves when it comes to discipleship: how far are we going to go, and what path are we going to choose? There are all these forks in the path, and there come times when we choose to go down the left fork or the right fork. And in the beginning of Bob's paper, he points out that even the position of rigor and responsibility are not one on the far right and one on the far left, but that both tend towards the left, both tend towards a radicalness. They tend towards an openness to newness and difference rather than what has gone on before, traditional status quo. So even before I make a few comments about the rigorous position in relationship to the responsible discipleship model, I'd like to reaffirm that they are both on the left and both on a far left fork of those branches of options. So if the question is how far shall we go, there seem to be a couple, not paradoxes, but dialectics that are set up somewhat. There's rigor almost set up versus responsibility. There, in some respect, it comes down to a question of effectiveness and faithfulness. Our way, what we seem to believe is going to be the best route to go versus the foolishness of Jesus' way. Limited commitment, or a commitment that goes so far, or unlimited commitment. None of these are mutually exclusive. They're elements of our discipleship, whether we tend towards the rigorous or the responsible brand of discipleship. One question that I had in reading the paper was, maybe it's going to sound nitpicky because it's a word, but I don't really, words are important. And one of those words is perfectionism. If you read through the paper, perfection was used as a label or a descriptive phrase on the attitude or the aim of the rigorous disciple. The biblical concept of perfection is not the same as perhaps that which we carry with us. When I think of perfect, in the general sense, I tend to think of 100%, you know, no error, right on the mark, absolutely there. Whereas in the Sermon on the Mount, where the call of Jesus is to be perfect, as your Father is perfect, perfect there in the Greek and other places in the New Testament carries a sense of wholeness, or of Jesus, in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, is talking there about unconditional love. And he describes unconditional love, and then he calls us to love in the same way. And so it's not that we 100% of the time would love, but to have an unconditional quality to our lives and our love of people. So rather than perfectionism, perhaps a process, to be in a process of becoming Christ-like. Discipleship being that evolution of our character and our mind into the mind of Christ and into the way of the cross, which no one is ever going to do 100% perfectly, but that we are in that process the question of the new and the old age, and whether we live in the one, or the fact that we live in the old age, but that as Christians we are called to be part of the new age. We do live in both, and the question is how. St. Paul time and time again says that we live in both ages. The kingdom is not fully here, but it is currently present. We are called to be a new humanity and a new society in the midst of an old one. And in a similar respect as Jesus, the cross that he bore and the cross, or the way of the cross that we might be called to live, is in some terms Rather, ultimately, it's going to be the price of our social nonconformity. The old order is going to resist the ways of the new. And so there in the crosshatch of two intersecting circles, we're still present in the old age, but we are a foretaste of the new age to come. And so it is in that respect that, yes, we live in the midst of the old, and we're called to be in a process of becoming more and more citizens of the new kingdom. The question, or just the reality of the cross, and the interpretation of the cross, is going to be an underlying decision or understanding that's going to influence which fork of discipleship people ultimately choose. I don't know if how many of Bob's phrases changed since this is a more of a rough draft paper than the copy you have.
The dialectic between the perfection and the responsible is much more drawn, much more starkly there than it is in the later version.
Okay.
The later version, I moderated that considerably because I myself felt that I had been unfair to the one position.
Okay. I
think that's the version you have. Marilyn and I have been in a long correspondence over a few years arguing, at least not arguing, but discussing these things, dialectic.
The statement, the cross is reality, the cross is reality at its worst. That begins kind of the discussion of where the cross is in relationship to our discipleship. The cross is also the place where God meets us at the point of our deepest need. And the cross is also the price of Jesus' radical freedom. And because of this freedom from possessions and powers, that alternate kind of power being a threat ultimately led to the intolerance of his life and way and his death. The resurrection, then, is described as going beyond the cross. The cross is not the last word in Christianity. It is followed and superseded by the ever-new word of the resurrection. In part, I think the position of Bridger would agree with that, but have to disagree, in that no, the resurrection does not supersede the cross, but it points right back to the cross, and that is the point of victory, and that it is the crucified Lord who is the crucified one who is Lord, and that it is suffering love, not compromise, that it is ultimately the way to life. Then there's the question of predisposition to one type of discipleship or another. And there's no doubt that we all have different temperaments, that we're all different people. We are all predisposed to be one type of person or another. But I guess I would have to quibble with whether some are predisposed to the more responsive position or the more rigorous position, in that we are all called to put on the mind of Christ. That we are all in a process of losing our self-will and by the power of the Spirit taking on or realizing the will of Him whom we call Lord.
Would you say that these predispositions would be starting points on the process towards becoming Christ-like? We're predisposed towards certain starting points.
Well, some of us tend to be more practically oriented, and I mean, how often have you been described as an idealist or the pragmatist? I mean, those are tendencies within all of us. Some people seem to be so full of common sense, and some people, seem to see the vision, and it almost seems foolish, and so, a label of idealism. And both people are in relationship. If they are a Christian, they're in a process of being, of putting on the mind of Christ. But ultimately, we are called to follow Jesus, not in ways that we can adapt ourselves to Jesus, but in that we will be, our mind, I keep thinking of Philippians 2, being emptied of ourselves, putting on the form of a slave. That's the model. Putting off our self-will and our self-determination and being molded into a new creature. As Paul says also, in Christ all things are made new. It is, I guess, another difference I would see basically between the two positions is that perhaps the responsible position argues for reformation or a transformation of things as they are by modification, and the rigorous position would see it as a nonviolent revolution. And that's, again, comes from a different interpretation, slightly, of biblical material. And as Bob's paper says, the rigorous position depending more upon the teaching and words of Jesus, whereas the other position uses broad biblical concepts. It's not that it is without a biblical base at all, but one leans more heavily upon the actual teaching as we have it in the gospel of Jesus.
The issue of starting points is a very interesting one in all this.
Mm-hmm.
Beware in any kind of writing that what is a person's starting point is a very crucial, has an often a very important bearing on where they end up. See, Marilyn says that I would take, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to take your starting point to be something like the process of being more Christ-like and all that ramification is the problem. The problem for me is less trying to be Christ-like than how does one live in a very rocky world. You see, with those two starting points, you yield entirely different places. Another starting point is how do you feel about the evilness of the old age? Is it in radical distinction from the new? Is in fact the fact that the kingdom is broken in even to that world mean that there are elements within our political organizations which reflect the new age? Again, there are very strong differences between Christians on how you look at the evilness of the old age, and the position that you tend toward tends to emphasize the evilness of the old age. The position that I tend toward tends to see some more ameliorated without overlooking the evil aspects of that old age. I don't know, you may have finished. I don't want to interrupt you before you finish here.
I guess that it, in some respect it comes down to a question of can we even predetermine which type of disciple we are? We can reflect upon that, but even if we decide, yes, I'm that type or I'm that type, then we'd be putting limits upon how far after Jesus we are willing to follow. Mm-hmm. We may find ourselves going down a fork that at this time we do not even suspect we'll go down. If we're truly open to the will of God, that's always a possibility. It tends to work in paradox rather than in what seems like under the logical consequence of what has been done. The way of the cross leads to change and discomfort and danger and the flip-flop of things. And do we say no when the cross looks impractical? And I guess to comment upon what you said, Bob, about how do we live in this current age?
At all.
How we live, we may end up living in a way that we believe is faithful and looks absolutely foolish. And that is to elevate, following, regardless of the results. But following what we see as the way of the cross or truth, whatever you want to call it. Whereas I think there's also the added dimension of the responsible position being that within each of us which tries to hang on to reality and say we know what must be done in order for the proper thing to happen in the end. We know what are some of the steps, at least, to get towards a good goal or a partially good goal. Whereas, I think in the rigorous position, it is to foolishly commit ourselves to what we see as the way of suffering love or unconditional love. And in the short term, it may look like unemployment for the poorest people in the social strata, which is an argument in the section on responsible discipleship.
The danger.
That by following some of our perceptions of what the foolishness of the cross might be, that might mean hardship for the poorest of the poor. It's in the question of lifestyle. If we all drastically cut back on our consumption, we would put a pressure upon our consumptive economic system that would bring about its decline, and those who would suffer first and most would be those who already do not benefit optimally from the system. That's a hard question in that reality. The question is, one, is that short-term leveling of the high eventually, in, you know, the foolish wisdom of God, going to make the low places high? Or there's a lot of kingdom language that kind of talks both ways about the destruction and the elevation. There's a lot in this paper. That's kind of it.
Well, let's open it up. Lois?
I'd like a little comment on the final paragraph of page 11.
Can I have the page? I don't have a copy of the paper.
This is the responsible consumption position, talking about how to make major purchases in good conscience beyond the basic needs. You buy a boat, and then you set aside the sum of the price of the boat as a gift to the food bank or an organization like the Urban League. Can you elaborate?
I'm trying to figure out how to make some practical suggestions at the end there.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be the ones that you might like to do or someone else might like to, but what I'm trying to follow up on is that there are some churches now who, when they decide to build a Christian education wing, insist that they raise twice the money for the wing.
Mm-hmm.
And they give half that money up over and above to missions or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that that's a fairly responsible way to do it if you've decided that the Christian education wing is important for the purpose of your ministry. Now, it could be that buying a boat isn't important for the purpose of your living a Christ-like life. I seem to think that if I went out and bought a canoe for the running of wild streams as a proper recreational kind of function, I think we have recreational needs, or this isn't a big thing, but buy a boot for hiking in the mountains. Those are things above basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
That when you, I don't want to be picky about this, that every time you buy a spoon or buy a shampoo for your hair that you set aside the same amount of money. But I think if you could start with at least the big element, when you buy a refrigerator that has the ice machine on the front, maybe something like that.
I guess I was looking at that last night, and I'm still not sure if I can even articulate what it is. I guess I think that if we choose to buy a boat or choose to buy hiking boots or choose to build an educational wing, that is a conscious choice that we are allowing ourselves the luxury of going beyond basic needs. There's something about matching the money that smacks of mockery of the gravity of the issue, and I don't have it together in my own being.
Well, is it the fact that it appears to be a compromise from what you hold to be the ideal?
It's saying I can make this okay if I give... I can make my way of living okay if I give a turkey to the people down the street that don't have anything at Christmas time.
I think,
go right on with making my decisions on the basis of what I want to do, rather than saying, is it time for me to radically evaluate? I guess I think that I personally need to be very aware of the luxury of my decisions, and that I am in fact choosing at the expense of another, and I can't pay it back quite that simply.
Well, I think you've highlighted the problem. The only thing I would comment is that because you choose that doesn't mean that you're denying somebody else something, given the fact that you're caught up in a whole system. If you don't consume that, it probably means nothing. In fact, unless there's some sort of systemic change, which mm-hmm. is why I think there's a need for the working for systemic change. Without that systemic change, it means that there's less demand, the price is lower, and someone else can have it for a cheaper mm-hmm. price. That's all it means. And mm-hmm. so you may be salving your own guilt feelings about consumption, but you're doing nothing at all for people who are really in basic need. Mm-hmm. And let me just come back and ask you a question. Are there legitimate consumption needs beyond basics that you feel that a Christian can indulge themselves in, so to speak? Is that being selfish, the opposite of selfless?
I don't know.
So far,
I have chosen the easiest route. I have indulged myself when I have chosen to do so.
Probably less than most Americans, however, would be my guess. Even articulating what you've articulated suggests to me that tussle between the ideal and the way you live is a problem which probably moderates what you're doing already. See, I would say the same thing about myself as you're saying.
There's an element of charity in this example that, well, if we look at the example of philanthropists, like the return of the century, Hill and J.P.
Carnegie.
Morgan and Carnegie, keeping the mass of wealth, not taking from your substance to give to those who live
your power
minimally or below, not giving up any power, but giving up your excess. No structures are changed, no attempt to change the things that keep the person poor that you're giving your charity to. And that's not to put down charity. Charity has a real function in that there are people suffering from the current system, and we need to try and meet their suffering at the time. Then the added dimension of either transformation or revolution is there. If the system is keeping people in places of poverty, if we're going to have not just charity but also justice, mm-hmm. then we are also called to be in a transformative process of either revolution or reformation. Mm-hmm. And does this example, is there an attempt by the person buying the boat, mm-hmm. And maybe, the boat's probably not, it's an example which is real for a lot of people, recreation equipment or something.
I don't know if anybody else would even see the relationship in this, but I just get in a sense in these women's magazines or whatever magazines that have this picture of the starving child, give your $15 a month and you can...
Christian Children's Fund.
Yeah. Well, Sally Struthers. Me, that is a quick and easy answer to the dilemma. And I really am leery of charity as a salve to our conscience and as an answer to the dilemma. I think it is much deeper than that. And if we say, well, I do this and I feel so much better because I know that I'm...
Without combining it with justice, and that's why in all this I've been insisting on justice, participation,
yeah.
sustainability. Mm-hmm. And the other position has problems there too. So you come up to Holden Village and make your life right with simplicity. You're salving your conscience there when you're doing not a damn thing for the poor people either. So unless either of the musicians...
I don't find that Holden Village is in any way a salve for the conscience. If anything, it makes me feel worse for me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to bring
it home because I think that there's sometimes some delusions by people who think that they're becoming more Christ-like, and I'm not trying to discredit the position because of this, but to say that either one of these positions can delude themselves about their goodness. I mean, we have many masks to pull over our face, and everybody does that.
argument can be made that the person who tends towards the rigorous position is actually seeking to find a clean place to stand. You know? But, and right there, and that perfectionism, if that is a part of the rigorous person's mindset, then, I mean, that's just a denial of reality, mm-hmm. of the realities of the old age, that we are all dirty. We all stand as part of the problem. We're never simply those who are working for change or solutions. We're always still part of the problem. So to us and them is just totally inappropriate because we are always the them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's us and them, we're all the same folk.
Yeah.
It's important.
I've been struggling an awful lot lately with this idea of what the cross means, because the way of the cross comes to be Christ-like means. I think the same passage as now, but the process of being kind of Christ-like. But what does that mean? It's like, what is the way of the cross? You know, the way of the cross doesn't mean take care of your own basic needs, if you look at it in a certain way. And I'm stuck.
This is, let me just peck around the outside of it. I don't think we're solving this problem, but let me add a dimension to that. In some respects, I don't think the ethics of Jesus or the lifestyle of Jesus was determined by his feeling about the nearness of the end. But I suspect it was influenced by it.
Mm-hmm.
And see, we're presented with a further problem is that in some respects, being like that it really is foolishness, and not just a spiritual sense, but in a sense of you're a drain on other people in the long haul. Now, if things are going to come crashing in very soon, you can perhaps handle that. But in the long haul, you got to be a tent maker like Paul, or in other places in Jesus. And here's the added further complicating dimensions: is that the ethics of Jesus and the biblical ethics, as I tried to point out, aren't all rigorous. The Old Testament is quite contrary about wealth and things like that. They celebrate it, in fact. What was the point I was trying to lead to? That Jesus says, count the cost. There's a couple passages in the teachings of Jesus which talk about having some sort of sense of realism about the way things are, counting the costs. And it's not just a kind of going whole hog with the carrying of the cross. Now, those are complicating dimensions that don't solve the problem.
There are also all sorts of ways that we could imitate Jesus. And I don't know if you've ever read the book In His Steps, but it's an interesting novel in that it talks about a group of people who decide they're going to imitate Jesus for a year. And they all kind of contract with each other to do this. Before they make every single decision, they're going to stop and they're going to say, what would Jesus do? Now that's one way you can try to imitate Jesus.
That's a new legalism, though.
Yes.
Disguised.
You know, we could all go barefoot, wear turn of the millennium clothes, you know, of the ages rather.
Keep carrying crosses on our shoulders.
Yeah, carry wooden crosses on our shoulders. Or, you know, there are all sorts of ways that we could imitate the cross, but there is a point of convergence. Or there are points of convergence in the New Testament between the Gospels, between the Pauline literature, the letters and works of John, that where they agree upon the point of imitation, and that is the point of suffering love, and again, that's pretty general, servanthood, replacing dominion, powerlessness, rather than buying into the power systems, speaking truth to power. John Howard Yoder even uses the phrase revolutionary subordination, where one radically opposes the system not by trying to overthrow it, but by living a different way within it. And that is so threatening to the system itself.
Do you think a Christian can be a member of Congress or a governor?
I seriously doubt it. Now, I don't know one way or the other, but I think that is...
But who takes care of those dirty, messy functions like that? who gets themselves down there in the pits where the people are hurting and tries to do something about it.
I'm not saying that a Christian does not have a role within the society and political functions and responsibilities. That's one way to be political, is to be within the system. Another way to be political is to stand as a dissenter in the midst of a system. And I know that, like,
you're still playing the old power game.
That's Christ against culture. To be in the minority, to continue to voice a minority opinion, to write letters to Congress people and representatives that you know are in the majority opinion, that you have a pretty good idea are never going to come into effect, is not necessarily power.
But then someone else has to do the dirty work, right? And then you sit on the sidelines and carp or write letters about the guys who are having to muck around in that mess. I have some respect for the people who muck around in that mess, and I guess I hope that there are some Christians among them.
I didn't say that I have no respect for them. I know that my position on that, most Christians would probably not agree at all. But I think that power transforms.
Has that tendency, yeah. Well, I don't think these, again, are mutually exclusive positions. I would hope that there are Christians who maintain this, too. But I think that there are as a valid role for Christians within the political system who are exercising power and doing it with some struggle and without some, you know, with some mistakes, too. I mean, they're using power. As soon as you use power, you're going to be using people. I mean, there's coercion that's involved in power. And all of a sudden you're not doing suffering divine love. When you're, it's not agape, it's not what governments do. Excuse me.
Yeah, what you would be saying is that there's maybe more power in living the new life rather than being compromised and being part of the old life and using the old power.
In respect, and that can also be an argument for apathy, for non-involvement, for withdrawing from society, and that's the danger of that position. But, well, just like taking the Pauline example of his letter to Onesimus, and Philemon, rather, about Onesimus, sending the slave back into the life of slavery. Some people criticized Paul because he wasn't more of a feminist, because he didn't stand in opposition to the slavery system of the Roman Empire. There is another argument, also using scriptural basis, that it is even more revolutionary to subordinate yourself to the way things are, but to live within it, in it, accepting your powerlessness, and that is ultimately transforming. That is ultimately threatening to the powers that be.
That would be revolution for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
It works in some situations. It gets smashed in others.
Yes, Daniel Berrigan says, you know, you better look good on wood.
Well, there's certain situations.
You know, there are consequences that it doesn't always work. It doesn't always transform immediately or even within the foreseeable future or eons.
In fact, if you're against a ruthless enough government, it leads to needless slaughter. I don't think an Adolf Hitler would be transformed by nonviolent power. I think he had no trouble sticking all those folks in the concentration camp and gassing them.
Well, you can take...
But would the kingdom win in the long run? If there was commitment to that kingdom, would that...
I think there are different forms of commitment. Only one form, which is being articulated here, and which I take to be a very important form of Christian commitment. I mean, this is what is being said in the effect of this paper, is that there are valid, it seems to be valid alternatives. And that we need people maintaining both of those. We need people who take the position that Maryland's taking vis-a-vis government. I think we need people in government who are trying to struggle with relating those ideals and with the inevitability of compromise that a political structure necessitates. I take that to be Luther's position in a sense, too, with the notion of vocation. Even the hangman can be a Christian. That's why there's forgiveness and mercy as part of the cross and resurrection. I don't have an answer. I tried to wrestle with some suggestions at the end, and I don't admit that I'll pretend that those are so solve that problem. I don't know if that problem has, there are a class of problems without solution, and there are momentary solutions or momentary ways which you find the kind of glimpse, if we can refer back to the parables, glimpse of the kingdom. I really think that if we take the cross seriously, that we have to realize that we're always faced with that problem. And everything, almost everything we do in our lives, and there's no avoiding that short of the kingdom of God, which we only feel or experience partially in this age. It's begun in Jesus Christ, and part of the beginning is to make us feel antsy and frustrated.
So maybe, like, your position to Maryland is probably the full spectrum of people, a continuum.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not like in one camp and in the other camp.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of...
But we're making the distinction for the purposes of highlighting the difficulties. I think that they do blur into each other. I don't know how far you blur down the line until you really have compromised away any kind of commitment to the ideal, which is stated by Jesus fairly well. I mean, it's not unambiguous, but what is at one point is that compromised? To the point where you've got something qualitatively other.
Mm-hmm. Well, like in the Lutheran tradition, there's the concept of status confessione, where the church can come to a place where, given a specific situation, they say, no longer is it ambiguous, no longer can we ride the fence on it's usually an issue. That in order to be part of the Church of God, part of the body of Christ, you must stand on one side or the other of the fence. The ALC just unanimously stood and agreed that apartheid in South Africa is such an issue for Lutherans. That you cannot support apartheid and be a Christian, so to speak.
Here I stand, I can do no other. There are those points.
But that much of the time things are very ambiguous. The question then of the rigorous disciple and the responsible disciple is that yes, they can both be in this process of relationship with the one they call Lord, but there could come hard points. There will come a time when they will have to choose, you know, who they really are going to trust in a given situation.
I would take the rigorous position would draw the line a little bit more, if I can use the analogy of the plumb line. Everyone knows what a plumb line is, don't you? Measures the vertical, and I say the rigorous position would draw the line at more nearly the vertical than the greater angle, which the responsible position, which I'm articulating and calling responsible. Mm-hmm. Not to say that rigorous position is irresponsible or anything.
And a rigorous position might have...
And one other point is that has been made is that perhaps that the rigorous position sometimes doesn't take the cross seriously enough and don't apply it to their own efforts again. And this is really to reiterate an earlier discussion about how either one of the positions can be a mask for doing. But the here I stand, I can do no other, the people who take that position often are accused of being having strong wills to power, and they're really being very selfish and hard-headed and not basing their position on some sort of commitment to the gospel. And in each of our lives, trying to differentiate when we make a stand between our own pig-headedness and what is validly the gospel, we have to always continually apply that cross back on ourselves. Which makes you go bananas, by the way. See, there's the dilemma. How do you still maintain a kind of ethical commitment at the same time you realize your own sin? I mean, that's still a very basic issue.
Take the issue, for example, of apartheid, because it's a very fresh one. The Lutheran Church having, or the ALC, I speak just for them at this point, having taken that stand, and it was a standing unanimous stand, mm-hmm. physically up out of your chairs.
Standing stand.
No, standing stand. The next step then becomes how does that in fact get carried out? And here we come in with the rigorous and the responsible lifestyle consumption. And it gets pretty sticky, because at that point, okay, the very rigorous says there are 450 major corporations in our country, where we can invest money. 350 of those have, I'm just picking figures out of the air, because I don't know if those are accurate, but 350 are involved in South Africa. Very rigorous within the ALCO saying, pull that money, not a penny should be invested in those 350 companies, because they are in fact supporting, helping to maintain the apartheid system. Invest it in those other 100 companies who are not involved there. The sticky part about that is those other 100 companies probably are involved in Haiti, with bananas or cocoa somewhere else, or have their money in Nestle's or you know. And so part of what that becomes is a decision over two bad options instead of one clean and one dirty. It's not so clear as that. And the other part of the people saying, okay, we are against apartheid, how do we carry that out? Probably, and it probably isn't fair to put these in pigeonholes, but just for sake of discussion, the responsible consumption might say, no, let's not pour money out of those companies, let's rather continue to be the conscience of those companies. We've got representation on the corporation, and we can help influence those decisions. Even though we may not change the decisions, we continue to be the leaven in the loaf, trying to prick consciences and call to awareness.
No, they're going further than that. They're saying industry is their only hope.
There's a lot of,
there's
a lot of church people in South Africa come in and say, we really want those companies there because they really are the only.
Just for the sake of the discussion, trying to come down to some specific area, and it does become tough choices.
Well, to me, one of the most comforting things about this is, I don't think it is impossible to live with this dilemma all your life. I think this is a question that never quite gets answered. It's one of the reasons I value the concept of daily repentance and forgiveness. I don't think you ever come to a decision for all time, for all situations, on what is a responsible response to the gospel. I think sometimes it's much more radical than others. And for two different people, it isn't the same thing.
Well, that's true for us.
Oh, yeah.
In certain decision-making processes, we both feel that we're trying to be open to responsible decision making, and yet we both feel very committed in terms of the Christian faith, and yet we may come out at
some
differing places in a given issue. And not only do we have the decision to live with, we have each other to live with at that point.
But I would hate to take one of these labels, I guess. I finished the paper and saying, all of this is true. And I would not fit either label.
Well, again, I tried to have a disclaimer at the start. Those are ideal types, but by seeing the distinction between the two positions, I think you begin to understand the dilemma that both you face and many Americans face. I've used this sort of thing in churches mm-hmm. before, and people are really hurting out there for mm-hmm. direction and on how to handle this kind of dilemma that they, you know, they're living styles of life which they feel in tension with what is the rigor. How can we live in that situation at all when we're caught?
And I want to say at that point is that that's what's so frustrating to me about rapid growing congregations who are quick to give simple answers to tough decisions, and why I think it's a major drawing factor within our country for certain types of churches. Because the pastors and or the basic policy of the churches are to give very clear, concise, simple answers, to take the onus of responsibility off your back. And all I can say at that point, three cheers for the folks who are willing to continue to struggle with the tough choices and to live in the ambiguity and the muck that isn't fun to live in. The very thing you're lifting, Cheryl. It feels uncomfortable. Oh, for a simple decision one day and know that it felt like it was the right one. And yet I think that is the responsible place to be. Now personally, I think that is a responsible place to be, and not where things seem so clear and crystalline and
smooth. Or where there's an assumption. The one congregation I worked these ideas in, there were 5 real estate developers, and boy, they didn't like what was being said. They were considered themselves Christian. I think that the dilemma that you're in is far superior. It's no easier to handle. That's personal opinion. I don't know. Maybe those Christians are right. I'm not going to judge for God whether the people owning real estate and pushing real estate in big buildings are wrong.
I don't think we have to end up saying, you know, that everybody can be right either. I think we have to make some choices and decisions, and just go, you know, that's right and that's just not. The thing of it is to realize that there are unredeemed aspects of our own self, our own brokenness and sin to which we are blind. Just as, you know, we might ultimately say, you know, the Afrikaners who claim to be Christians and are members of the Dutch Reformed Church and go to church every Sunday and have devotions with their family and, you know, have a pious faith, as they call it, in Jesus Christ, and they are pro-apartheid down to the, you know, soles of their feet, you know. Status Confessionis is saying they are not Christian. They're calling themselves that, but they aren't. That's an extreme case, but I think even as we decide, you know, if we think, you know, that you can't be a Christian and be in the Nestle Corporation, or if you think that would be an unredeemed function of your life, then, if you work for Nestle Corporation and just don't even see that might stand against the gospel, is to say, you know, that there are those things about myself that I don't see. You know, and I think there are clearly things that are right and that are wrong. You know, that's the nature of reality, and then there's all sorts of grays. But not to condemn people and say they are not in a process of becoming Christ-like because certain aspects of them are not under the lordship of Christ. I know that sounds, I have trouble even believing that myself, but I believe it.
One difference I think between Marilyn and myself is that I think the gray area is bigger and the black and white area, the right and wrong area, is very much smaller. I am really stuck after 40 years with the ambiguities.
Yeah.
But being stuck with the ambiguities of life, of course, has a very kind of emasculating, if I could use that word. Really, it's a sexist term in this sense, but it's a very strong sense of where you've cut the cord of ethical rigor. When you mm-hmm. finally look at all ambiguities, and that's a real danger. And so one of the things I've always felt from Reinhold Niebuhr, is that somehow you've got to keep that tension between an appreciation of the ambiguity, at the same time that factoring into your judgments and your whole spirit is the element of rigor. And they really got to both be part of you somehow. It's not an easy mix, and it's not one that's going to make you feel comfortable all the time. But as soon as you lose one or the other, you're going to lose something you're going to make serious ethical errors in terms of judgment and activity. Standing with 2 feet, one in one world and one in another. Well, it's 20 to 12. If I don't know if there's any other comments, I don't want to either prolong this or to cut it off prematurely.
Well, could you repeat what you said, using an example of the Nestle Corporation? If you were an executive for Nestle and they were doing something that was unchristian, then that person... Are you saying that you could say that person then is can't be a Christian?
No. Let me use a different example that for me is very much alive.
Yeah.
I think a Christ-like response to power is to challenge broken power in a nonviolent manner. I am a pacifist, and I come... Mm-hmm. No, not that I can live that 100% perfect, perfectly, but that is where I come down. So then what's that, what do I think then about all people who are not pacifists and who do not see that as an essential part of the gospel or of the way of Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do I do about that? You know, do I think, well, I am right and they are wrong. I am a Christian, they are not. It's not that simple. Whether they see justifiable reasons for violence, and if I just think that is an illusion, you know, that that's a short-term way to look at conflict, then that is, that's simply the way I see it. Now, I don't know that I can live that out or could live it to the point of death, but that's the way I see it now. That person who is not a pacifist could look at me, and can, I'm sure, and see all sorts of unredeemed, ungospel aspects about my life and my actions.
Even accuse you of having illusions about the short and long range.
So we're in, essentially, you know, in very much the same place. You know, and ultimately I cannot say who is a Christian and who is not. I mean, just, you know, again, the paradoxes of God. Probably the people we think aren't.
Well, it could be that both those
maybe
sides
all the atheists and none of the Christians are going to be, but they're just, you know.
Well, we are just absolutely not called to do that.
No, but we are called to
make judgments.
To make judgments. I mean, there's, you know, Jesus saying that judge not lest you be judged, and then in Mark he says there's a command to judge, and the Greek is different in both places. One is harshly criticize, do not harshly criticize lest you be harshly criticized. The other is to judge in the sense of sober
discrimination.
Discrimination.
I just,
so, you know, the blanket,
as it affects you and the advice you give when asked, not for you to go around.
Well, no.
I think even further,
true.
Yeah,
no,
and what your activities are.
As a gospel, which is not there in the context of that verse. We're called to make decisions. We're called to discriminate.
One is to judgment in the sense of criticizing somebody else. Another one is a different activity, which is the positive push for or attain what you see to be the God's will or God's working in that situation. That really means separating things from each other.
Isn't that in a sense personalizing?
Well, it could be on a social scale.
It
could
be.
It could. Do I go to war, or do I join the army, or don't I join the army?
Whatever your decision is a function of what you are, and your perception of what you see as reality, and what you see as the cross.
You know.
Plus the reality of the Spirit actually living within you, mm-hmm. and the will of God. God is in there.
If you're open.
If you're open to that.
Yes.
Yeah. You can delude yourself about the whole thing, of course. Oh dear. You trust.
And then you blow it. I mean, you do.
Uh-huh. And then you don't blow it, too.
Sometimes you don't.
But yeah, that's a real easy one to try and tell everybody that you can't stand anywhere. You can't take any stands is, you know. But we're called not to judge. We're told not to judge.
But that's kind
and
of
it's a bit too simple.
I take that judging is to say, merely because you don't agree with me, you're out of the kingdom. Now that's a facile, stupid, self-centered judgment on my part, if I would say that. I actually believe it. No, I'm serious. But to say that I differ with you, or maybe we would come out differently on I may decide that this battle is something that I feel is that I may have to kill somebody over for the protection of justice or something like that. And she would say that's deluded. I have illusions about the long range and so forth. We're making judgments there without being critical of each other, I think, mm-hmm. in the sense of saying that you're a non-person because you hold something different than I am. I think we will be continuing. I have a suspicion we'll be continuing these discussions next week when John comes. John will add his own dimensions to this, and I will, and Marilyn will be present. I assume you'll be present. Have you heard him so much that you probably will? I don't know. I hope you are, so we can continue to wrestle with these issues. John has some very definite perspectives on these, which are, I think you'll find, very illuminating and helpful. Peace.